Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jiltra Bilcock Now on People's Internet Radio. Today, we've got a very sort of a whole lot of things going on here. We have Professor Stuart Twemlow, who we're going to be speaking with about a number of things. We're going to be talking about the Bundy Ranch, even though he doesn't know it, because I'm very upset about the fact that at the Bundy Ranch, people suggested using women and children as shields. And I want JAG, who is our lawyer, who's also sitting there, his opinion on the ethics of that and Stuart's opinion on that. We're also going to be talking mostly about LSD, psychotropic drugs, whether they're natural, things like that, and how good it is to have take mind-expanding drugs in the right circumstances or not. I nearly mentioned MK Ultra, and when I put that up on the advertisement, Facebook took it down, so we won't be talking too much about MK Ultra, but just maybe a tiny bit. And then we're going to be talking about Stuart, who's had a couple of papers released, which I want to ask him about as well. But Stuart's disappeared, so that's rather handy of him.
I'm sure.
And Jag is sitting there with a very pretty pink turban on. Jag, is that a new hot pink turban you're wearing?
Well, you talked about it last time. I'm
This one here is not new, but I don't think you've seen it.
No, I haven't
Yes,
seen
I
that.
have.
All right, so welcome Jagdeep Singh Sehgal and Professor of Psychiatry Stuart Twemlow to People's Internet Radio.
Very good.
Right, so Stuart, the top of your head is very enchanting.
Is
Yes.
Jill, it's Snow White.
And it used to be blonde.
I told you the lady, I had my hair cut Saturday, and a lady asked to buy the hair that was cut off.
That's right.
She wanted Snow White's hair to make some weird roses.
I always wonder what the color of people's hair was before it became Snow White. So
Well,
yours was blonde.
the history of my hair is weird. I've sold it twice. During my hippie phase, I was wasteland. And the color of it was gold, and it was even in color. So people would yank it constantly, thinking it was a wig. And I
Oh,
sold it to hairdressers. I got $100 in the 70s for it
good
on
on you,
occasion.
Stuart.
Which brings us to our topic, LSD.
Yes. Yeah,
Yes,
it's all hippie.
we do want to get to our topic on LSD. But first, I just want to talk about what you both of you, as a psychiatrist and as a lawyer, what do you think of the statement that somebody said about using in the Bundy Ranch standoff? This guy said that he would like to have used, and I only want to cover this for 3 minutes, that he would like to have used women and children. If they're going to shoot people, we'll put the women and children up the front because then we'll show the full horror of what they're doing. And I think it's completely like throwing the children under the bus. Like, you can't use women and children. I mean, that's not a thing for a man to say, is it? There's not, it's like me saying, I'll use you, Jack. I can't say, I'll use you because you're a Sikh with a pink turban on your head. It's up to you to say, I've got a pink turban on my head. I will volunteer myself. What do you think, Stuart? You need to
No,
get
no,
in
no.
the camera.
I think the idea is, if you have women up the front, it makes or it sort of ensures that people don't shoot, because if they do shoot, then well, I guess what they were arguing was a bit of a silly sort of argument, but I can see where it came from. You know, from the depths of someone's grey matter, saying that, you know, if someone shoots, then the world will see that they're shooting women, and nobody likes that.
Right, that
You're
was done.
obviously repulsed by the idea yourself, so it you know, would have worked. But
Well, I'm
that
saying the women should volunteer. You can't just say, I'll put a
yeah,
man or a woman or a child up the front.
true at
But
all.
do we know that they did not volunteer?
No, we don't know that. We don't know that. But there
Maybe
was
they
a,
did.
if
Maybe
the
they did.
women and children, if the women volunteered, then well and good.
Oh, yeah, well, why not? But
Yeah. So go on.
which I guess is interesting, because why is it okay for us to watch someone shooting men, but not okay for us to watch someone shooting women?
Exactly. And that was the
You're
guy's
saying
point. Okay.
no one should be shot. Do you know what I mean?
Let me break in here. First of all, this is not just a suggestion. It's been done. And
Yeah.
three of you know that. It's been done very recently.
Yeah.
Arch criminal there was Saddam Hussein, who regularly did that all the way through Iraq, using barriers of women and children to protect himself. So there's absolutely nothing new about this whatsoever. His goal was to do exactly what you said, Jack, to make it harder for people to shoot. Because shooting some people that traditionally in the world of gender and in the world of the gender I was brought up in, i.e. Men are dominant, hunters and protectors, and women are basically servants and baby bearers. That particular view was that they didn't have a role in fighting.
Yeah.
Now, the only army, to my knowledge, that fully allows women to participate in warfare is Israel.
Yeah. And it's
been the case now for many, many, many years. The United States is very, very close to allowing women to be in frontline combat. They already are in the Marines, and they have had to modify some of the strength requirements because women aren't strong enough to do some of the things, but they're certainly bright enough, and their pain tolerance and their persistence is better than men's in a setting. Now, the third group here are children.
Yes.
When you get into the child issue, then you've got a complex point of view. I mean, I would find it absolutely, well, it would be impossible. If I had a bunch of children in front of me and I need to shoot them, I'd put my gun down. I simply couldn't do it, and that's very, very personal. You don't want to hear the origins of bullets with me, but I can tell you this. If I see you or anybody else ill-treating a child, you will not find it pretty.
Good on you.
Very personal.
My understanding of my reading of the thing was that I don't think they were going to put children up the front. I think it was just women.
Women, yeah.
But anyway.
Okay.
The Sikhs allowed women in frontline warfare 300 years ago.
Is that right?
Yep.
Really?
Yep.
That's fascinating, Jack.
Very advanced.
You know how it happened?
No. They didn't have guns then, did they?
Lack of soldiers.
They had guns, but you know, mostly swords and spears and things like that. But they had guns as well. It would depend, because a lot of the guns back then were, you know, single round and then. Muskets as well as, you know, rifles. You'd have to read.
Come on, hurry up. Yeah. Don't take too long. I want to get onto LSD.
Why?
Basically, the way it worked was the men ran away because it was a battle that we're going to lose. The men ran away, and the women who were the wives of those men said, "How dare you run away?"
Well, there you go. I just talked. Women are much better at persisting than men. They're tough.
Well,
If I had a choice between facing a woman in battle and facing a man, I would face a man every single time. The best fighters I've ever trained, and I've trained dozens of fighters to competition level fighting, the best have all been women, every single one of them.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot to mention Stuart is a black belt in something or other, aren't you, Stuart?
In something or other, yeah, right.
Yes. What is your black belt in? What martial art?
And I have a black belt, an advanced black belt, 7th degree black belt in the Okinawa Kenpo system, which was originally karate. It was named that, the generic term, but it was originally Okinawate.
LSD. Do you have a black belt in?
Black belt in the weapon system of Okinawa, and also a black belt in Aikido and Eagle Claw Kung Fu, which is a secret pressure point system.
I'd like to learn that one.
You have to touch your shoulder and you would drop unconscious. There you go. Ooh, like that.
That sounds like fun.
And so you need to be thoroughly scared of me. Whatever I say is absolutely correct.
If you're scared of being unconscious, that is.
You should do sessions where people want to come for massage or for relaxation. You just touch them and they go down and stay there.
You know, we don't want to get too far off track here.
We don't.
The system I could show you where I can knock you out. I won't touch your head at all or your neck. I will touch just your shoulders, arms, and thighs a couple of times, not hard, and you will go out so quickly when you come to, you will not know you've been knocked out.
Well, that sounds good.
What happens in boxing or in street fighting There's always a piece of time as you go down and go out that you know you're falling, you know you've taken a shot. This stuff is so quick, you'll come to and say, what happened?
Okay, well, Stuart, you used to experiment with people with LSD, I'm really interested in that.
Well, let's just call them psychedelics. Can we do that?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about psychedelics. And also, did you have to take psychedelics so that you could be a good psychiatrist when you're experimenting with psychedelics?
Yeah.
Of course you were. And so they were legal at that time. Psychedelics. At what point in your life did you have to take psychedelics?
We did all this research in the 70s, between 1970 and 1980. The project was funded by NIMH, which is the Institute of Mental Health, federal agency that controls a great deal of major funding. And so it was all above board. I had a license to prescribe LSD, and I wrote prescriptions for it. And Sandoz, who manufactured LSD, gave all its supplies to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA.
They bought 10 tons or 10 kilos or something,
yeah,
didn't they?
Amount of it. And so it was doled out from there in pure form. And then all of the therapists who used it had to go through sessions where they took high doses of LSD under controlled conditions and answered psychological tests. We also went through some blood tests to make sure it didn't damage chromosomes.
Oh, yeah.
I went through several of those so-called high-dose sessions. They were hard to distinguish, very, very hard to distinguish from street doses, because we started at about the level of 2, 4, 6 street hits would be the lowest dose we would have used at one time. And it went up, it went up to 20 street hits. After that, there's a risk with LSD of seizure.
Oh, I bet there is. Well, I believe the guy who took the first trip, what's his name? Hoffman.
Which one?
The guy who invented it. Sorry, the cat's in the way. The guy who invented it, his name's Hoffman, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, he took 20 times the amount he was meant to take on the second or the first deliberate amount he took, because he didn't really realize how much he should take.
No, not for you. I mean, you're measuring this in micrograms.
Yeah.
It doesn't, you can't taste it, it's nothing.
Well, I'd sort of like to begin with my conclusion, Stuart, which is that a lot of the tests that people did on LSD, when I took LSD, which was only 3 times, I was very lucky because I was with people who really knew what to do. And so they said, you have to take it in nature. And yet some of the people who, some of the experiences that people, when the American Army got hold of it and said, all right, this is a fabulous mind-altering drug. We can use this to control people's minds. And they would literally stretch some people to the bed and put them through horrific experiences. And so the actual mechanism of LSD I'd like to discuss, and the fact that mind-altering substances, which you can, like psilocybin, appear naturally in nature, and the fact that our brain actually has receptors for these things, and they use them in all sorts of natural ceremonies, different things. You know a fair bit about this, but that's where I'd like to steer the conversation to the importance, you know, because some people get really anxious and they freak out, and if they're not with a good person when they're taking LSD, then it's not really such a you know, they can get really anxious and have a nervous breakdown, and some people can go mad. And I was watching a couple of LSD experiments, and I thought, if I was with that bloody experimenter in that room, I wouldn't like it. I'd say, just go away. I'm out of here. Like, I want to go out and look at the Rufus Crown emu wrens and some flowers and nature, rather than being bullied by some bloody awful bully.
No, I see your point. I remember after one session, I'd had a very, very difficult time. I was sort of carried out there with somebody under each arm, and it was sunset. And I remember seeing the sun setting behind this beautiful oak tree. And this had a lot to do with the fact that oak became my favorite tree. And I saw this tree and I saw this setting, and I went into an ecstatic state of wonderment. Maslow called a peak experience. And my insight was that I had survived this 13 hours of hallucinating. I'd lost 6 pounds in weight and I was still alive. And it was the thought of being alive still after all of this that was a peak thing for me. It is intense. Very, 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 very intense. I mean, it's exhausting. I mean, you lose weight. But let me just say a couple of things about the context of it in the United States and the world. LSD, Hoffman invented it. I think he was Swiss, and he's a sort of a maverick of a guy. He brought it, I think, to the United States to see if anybody was interested in it. He thought it may have some experiences, some value in psychiatry, because it tended to amplify both conscious and unconscious experience. You think of LSD as a massive amplifier, mm-hmm. and that's what it does. And so in the United States, interestingly, and this has been repeated, the Ivy League schools got very interested in it. I don't know why, but that's how it started. It started at Harvard, who started a big project to look into its psychological impact. And one of the people that really got to study it was, his name was Timothy Leary. He later became one of the founders of the New Age, along with his sidekick, Richard Alpert, who was also a psychologist at Harvard, who is now called Baba Ram Das, a holy yogi. Mm-hmm. Baba Ram Das was a consultant to our project, and we saw mm-hmm. him frequently. Timothy Leary got himself hooked up, interestingly, with the FBI, and we didn't like his sort of military style, but he did come see us quite often. Anyway, he was the articulate man, and he and Alpert took large amounts of LSD and psilocybin, which is a mushroom-derived psychedelic. These are all harmaline compounds, and they used it to study intensely their own mind, and they did it in very structured ways. Some of Leary's psychological tests are still used. He was an extremely capable psychologist, Harvard trained, you know, not a small community college type at all. And then after, I think there was a breakup between Leary and Alpert and the university, and they both left and started to promote the use of LSD to explore one's mind in what were called work groups. And Leary was really an academic. I mean, that was his training, and that's what he did. And several years from about 1965, which is when he left Harvard, about three maybe till 68 or 69, LSD research was like clinical research. It was done scientifically. People kept records for it and tried to understand themselves better. Then at that same time, and in the previous 10 years, starting in Great Britain, there was the beginning of what were originally known as bodgies, and they grew out of the lower working class, the sort of cockneys of London. Mm-hmm. And then they later became known as beatniks. Don't ask me why. And they were politically very anti-government, but they were.
I like the beatniks.
Yeah, they weren't involved with drugs at all. Drugs were not part of their deal. No drugs. Mm-hmm. Was all anti-government. They did like marches, and they started marches, the whole concept of marching on the government. And then in about 1967 or 8, there was a book published called The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
That's right.
If you haven't read it, you should read it.
Yeah.
And it introduced the idea that LSD could be fun, and you could have a party with it.
Yep.
You wouldn't have to research anything at all. You could just turn on, they called it, turn on, tune in, drop out
that's
for right. you want.
That's and right.
The hippie began. Hair started growing longer. Necklaces were being worn by men as well as women. And a number of the early hippies who lived in America in San Francisco around, you know the place, very famous meeting of two roads, some of them began to see things that interested scientists who were somewhat mystical. And one of those scientists worked at the Menninger Clinic.
Yep.
And he started to take a significant interest in LSD, not just as a work object, a work tool, but as an opener into a part of the mind that became known as transpersonal. In other words, what is it that transcends human individuality? What is it that unites us all as a being?
Yes, this is where I wanted to go, Stuart, because I want to make sure that we get to the basis of consciousness here and not just talk about how it evolved, because I am very interested in what actually the perceived wisdom of the nature of mind is what I'm interested in.
Well, then here's what happened. Then the whole LSD movement split. In 1968, in Council Grove, Kansas, which is a little tiny country town of about 700 people, we started to have meetings at a church camp every year, first week after Easter. Those meetings are still going on.
Well, come on, Stuart, cut to the chase. I want to talk about the drug experiences, not the history of it.
No, but
because we're halfway through. You know I love you. I don't mean to insult you that way. I mean, let's get there.
To this first, because I'm not.
I know. It's okay.
You know me. I mean,
I do.
Context to me is
everything. Yeah.
Won't have context, I'm not going to say anything.
Okay, I want your context because I want you. Come on, keep going.
So in 1968, this conference started of serious people. One of them was called Abraham Maslow. He established a style of psychology called humanistic psychology.
Yep.
Another was Stanislav Grof, who had done a lot of early work with LSD. He was a psychoanalyst. Mm-hmm. And then there were dozens of others, Stanley Krippner, Montague Ullman, who were all doing a lot of research. Elmer Green, who invented biofeedback, was working at the Menninger Clinic. And ever since then, that conference has invited 100 invitees to a secret think tank that has decided the role for LSD compounds in changing the social structure.
Right.
So the work ethic piece of it continued. The rest of the world took the electric Kool-Aid acid test. And that's what you seem to be interested in. It's like, how do you play with LSD? But what I got to tell you.
I'm not talking about playing. It's making the assumption that I would play with LSD. And I don't like that assumption.
Well, listen, Jill, the word play does not imply anything negative at all. I think you're overreacting to something from your childhood. Play is a very complimentary term. I am not trivial. I really mean play. And that's exactly what people use it for. And many people got a lot out of it that way. But there was also this other group. Now, that group met intensely. We got shut down by Senator Edward Kennedy.
Yes.
He was the most liberal senator in the United States Senate because...
And they're all on LSD themselves, the Kennedys, anyway.
Well, they may have been, but his problem was a CIA agent who had LSD put in a cocktail and jumped out of a skyscraper and killed himself.
Yeah.
He stopped our work, and we had to look for suicide rate and alcoholics. And after that, nobody else started it up again until recently.
That's right.
Every year there's a big meeting, and Stanford and Harvard have started up again using LSD.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm interested in is the use of ecstasy to help depressed old men. How about that?
I want to try ecstasy. What were you going to say, Jag? I've never tried ecstasy. I'll probably
go off. I think he's got the wrong pill. Isn't he thinking about Viagra? Or you need both.
There is a group.
Get up and then stay up all night.
And high LSD at the same time. The type of perversion, and there's a sort of hostess who will handle that sort of man. But so anyway, that the context, I just wanted you to see where all this fits. Now, the question of what is the mystical experience, or what researchers call peak experience.
Yes.
People like Otto Rank called it religious experience. Mm-hmm. And when I did my sessions, I'm going to tell this to you because I don't care if you believe it or not. Okay.
Oh, I believe you. I'm gullible.
I don't care if you do. All right. I'm just going to tell you. I wouldn't tell you if I did because I'd be embarrassed to say it.
Forget the whole world. I mean, this is on tape, Stuart.
It does not matter to me at all. It's so improbable that you will think I'm either making it up or have forgotten something.
I love it.
All right. So here's what happened to me. Mm-hmm. I went through a very intense LSD trip. I think it was my third trip. And I remember vividly identifying with Jesus Christ.
Ah.
And I remember in the experience, the feeling of the cross being dropped on my shoulder.
Wow.
Apparently, I was lying in a special room designed for LSD work, and apparently I fell off the bed as if I had been sort of slapped across the back. And the cross fell on my shoulder, and I dragged it, and I went through a whole crucifixion experience, which is immensely painful, form of torture that was common enough in those days, commonly used. Now, during the experience, this is what happened. When I went through the torture and I went through the experience, I began to bleed from my hands.
You didn't.
I began to bleed from my head.
In real life?
In real life. In
a blood, stigmata.
In the laboratory as my blood. And guess wow. where it came from?
Where?
My wrists.
Your wrists.
You know why that's significant?
No.
Do you know the usual crucifixion through the
yes. head? Yes.
That will never work. You know why?
Wrist.
Because you don't off. Sever the artery. The
weight of the body will tear through the hand.
Of course it will.
The crucifixion nails were always done through the wrists. They were stabilized in the wrists. That's where I was bleeding from.
That's a really amazing
where I was bleeding from on my head. You know the
yes.
crown of thorns?
Yes.
I wasn't bleeding from there. I was bleeding from all over my head. The crown of thorns was not a crown of thorns. It was a cap of thorns.
Wow, Stuart, this is a...
on top of the head of the guy as a form of torture.
Yep.
Now, how about that for weirdness?
I believe you 100% because I'm gullible, as I said, but not only that, because I'm just like the stigmata. I believe this happens to people with stigmata, and it's extraordinary.
So what about people with stigmata? You know I've had stigmata. So do you now think I'm somebody you should be following?
Oh, that would
maybe
be stigmatizing.
Well,
you know me. I believe in you don't know me, but I believe in checking. Oh, I've just been in the chat box of the last guy. There's been a guy on called Mark Passio, and I agree with an awful lot of what he says, but when I don't agree, I have to argue. You know, when I see a leap of faith or a jump in logic, you know, a slippery slope argument or a straw man argument. So I'll follow you a lot of the way, Stuart, but would you explain, would you please explain from a psychological or a psychiatric point of view how this happens, just sort of for the sort of... the uninitiated.
Well, I can't explain it, but let me just say what
something says I might close. So if I close, Jag, you're going to have to carry on. I don't know. Go on. I might fall out. Keep going.
Okay. Here's one other fact. In the news recently, there's been the discovery of a fish that is both able to breathe underwater and able to breathe on land.
All right.
Also, it has front fins that it can use like feet, and it can crawl up on land and move at fast pace, dragging the rest of its body behind it. It can do push-ups, actually.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of our heritage. I removed some gills from the neck of a man who happened to be an Adam and Eve type of person. And when I said to him, those are remnants of your gills, he reported me to the hospital director.
When you were a surgeon, you did this?
Yes. We are evolved from all animals. We started as primitive animals, like a fish, like a monkey, like an amoeba. That's part of our history. There's a connection between all of us that goes back from the beginning of the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
All of us contain the experience of Jesus Christ.
Yes. You're doing it as very Jungian.
Absolutely.
As collective unconscious.
That's all I got to say.
So you're saying that we have a memory for people to have stigmata. I don't get it. You need to explain it to me more clearly. I'm sorry, I've got heaps of messages coming from internet world here telling me that there's a problem with my browser and I have to relaunch it. But I'm just trying to ignore it. But what I don't understand is you've said you've removed gills from a person and you've explained that that doesn't make sense to me sort of genetically, like why I mean, that makes sense. I can see how someone could have guilt, you know. And also, I actually believe the mind is more creative than people realize. And when you're in the embryonic phase, when you're an embryo within the womb, that's something that I'll have to look into when we're in that fish phase. But the other thing is that you're saying that we have stigmata. You're saying it's because of a collective unconscious experience. And so on an absolute level, then there's an aspect of us that it is actually connected with the Christ sort of.
Just Christ, with every single human being.
Yeah.
We contain our own collective racial history.
And that's why you bled?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to buy it because it is Easter.
Everything for me. It made it 1,000 times more intense than it would have been normally.
What did? What made it 1,000?
LSD.
Yeah. So you've got it right from the psychiatrist's mouth, everybody. So you can tell your psychiatrist anything, particularly if he's Stuart Twemlow.
I'll keep my mouth shut now, and you go ahead and tell me what you think.
We love your mouth. Come on, Jag, what do you think?
Well,
Jag's a lawyer, everyone.
I am, but I mean, my own views on the world are interesting. They're different. No, a lot of people probably would agree with me. Most people probably won't agree with me. It depends on your own background and the way you were taught, probably. But I mean, look, I'm a firm believer in the fact that if your mind is, I guess, experiencing something, and it could be seeing something, feeling something, whatever, that your body will respond accordingly. I mean, that's an obvious sort of thing. If you have a dream and you wake up in a cold sweat and your heart's beating and you look down and you think, oh, not again. You know what I mean? Sort of thing. So your body, I think your body is really not the king. It's more your mind that is. And you know, what happens in your mind, really dictates what the body feels. And, you know, it's the age-old sort of thing of, you know, a person acting out their dream. Well, not acting out their dreams, rather, but you know, dreaming something and then you know, having that happen to them. So, as an example, if you're hurt in a dream, you might wake up and your arm is sore the whole day. Is probably the more common experience that most people will feel, without LSD. And I'm sure. I'm sure that, you know, like Stuart was saying with LSD, how it amplifies the mind talking to itself, might be exactly one of the reasons why instead of just waking up with a sore arm, you're waking up and your wrist is bleeding. You know what I mean? Sort of thing. It's just more intense. It's the same thing that people feel on a day-to-day.
You can do that with hypnosis. I mean, I can hypnotize you and touch your arm with my finger and say, I just touched you with a hot cigarette, and your skin will blister.
I need to ask you, Stuart, this is actually from the chat box, but it was I actually said to them it's documented because you said that they had blood samples and they analyzed them and they were your own blood. What witnesses were there? This is for the sake of people who have healthy skepticism. What witnesses were there to this, and what documentation is there on this?
Well, I mean, this was an experiment, so there's a lot of documentation. There was pre- and post-testing. I had two experts with LSD sitting with me all the way through the session, which I think lasted about 12 or 13 hours, observing me, and I was speaking. And then I had a three-day period where I dictated my experiences. This work was done with verbally gifted people, which I was considered to be verbally gifted, because nobody could explain LSD. It was ineffable, as the academics call it. It was beyond words, but there was an attempt to try and describe it. So I spent 3 days dictating the experience each time I took it. So there was a lot of experimental data that was available on observations of me and documentation of the bleeding, and it was considered to be what Raj said, a manifestation of my own mind and its impact on my body. However,
who the hell's Raj?
What?
Who the hell's Raj, Stuart?
Raj, that's you.
No, it's not.
Yes,
it's
I
Jag.
Know. I know. Now, why do I call you Raj?
I get Raj all the time. Don't worry, that's fine. Now, carry on, Ellen.
What does it mean, Raj?
Raj is rule.
Well, you have a very commanding presence.
Thank you.
Anyway.
Thank you, Peter. You rock.
So it is documented, this situation.
Yeah.
This,
okay.
Fantastic. I'd love to see the documents one day. And I think they should. I think you should make a book on them, Stuart.
Well, yes.
The memoirs of a man with snow white hair.
I tell you what, I have one son who's a writer and a poet. And
yes.
He's talked about wanting to do it. I don't have time. I'm writing lots of other books. And I'm
well,
not...
it's interesting.
You know
it's
what you should do? You should just dictate it and the computer will type it for you.
Yeah, I know that dragon speaking naturally. Yeah.
You don't even need that if you've got an Apple, you just press function twice and it starts dictating.
Yeah, right.
Mm.
Well, here's the issue. A lot of stuff came out of that LSD work, high dose LSD work, that was done in a clinical setting with all of the pundits watching. It was very straight, very funded, very honest, very non-criminal.
Yep.
After that, we, I mean all of the high LSD takers were spread all over the United States, formed sort of a band, and we agreed to catch each other's back, and we agreed to give each other support. And all of us entered a whole nother life. When I came home, my wife said to me, "You're not the same."
All right.
I'm leaving you.
I'm leaving you.
I wasn't. And then the whole, you know a little bit, Jill, about the parapsychology phase. I went into years of research in parapsychology and was lucky enough because of my position to see the world's best psychics in action. They all came to be examined in our psychophysiology lab. And I saw people like Uri Geller and all of these amazing characters. And I saw psychic stuff that in broad daylight, right out in the sunlight, not on the stage, not when you've been drinking or smoking pot, which I don't like, by the way, and just happened. I mean, there's no question these things do happen. I saw them over and over again. I have videotapes of some of the stuff. And this son, who's the writer, he wants to write it up.
I think he should.
I think I might have made it up until I have a 50-year-old daughter. And when I was in the middle of the stuff, I didn't know if I was in the reality of the world or not.
Yes.
I knew if I could see your lips, if they were moving, that you were talking. If I didn't see your lips, it still sounded like talking. And you would see it as me responding to your thoughts before you'd said them, which might freak you out. Anyway.
I've had that experience with my son.
Have you? Really?
He's spoken to me.
My daughter was in a little cafe in Nashville, Tennessee. We were having a hamburger. My wife was there, and I used to smoke, and I had a cigarette, and I lit it, and then my hand disappeared. And she screamed. People had blushed. And then my hand reappeared, and the cigarette had gone all the way down. It was just a line of ash. And I thought, God, you know, Twemlow, you made that up.
Yeah.
I just spoke to her about it on her 50th birthday.
Yeah.
At that time, maybe 18. She burst into tears. She remembered directly.
Did you ever freak out? Jill,
I don't freak out, Jack. I never freak out.
No, it's a question from one of the listeners, that's all. Did you ever freak out?
Never, ever, ever. Not during LSD, not on it, not off it, not when my wife saw me in the corner of a room and she could see through my body, but she could recognize my features.
Yeah.
Not into LSD or any of this weird stuff at all. Over and over again, these experiences, I stopped doing all this in 1984 when a colleague and I wrote a book about them. Mm-hmm. Brenda said I could send you a copy. We actually made about $10,000 each on this book.
What was the book called? You'll make $1 million out of this book, Stuart.
It's called With the Eyes of the Mind, which is a comment of Goethe's. And it's in 1984 was published, and then I put it away and got into violence.
Oh, yeah,
well chosen.
organized violence.
And I no longer am interested in the ESP stuff, except every so often somebody calls me and says, yeah. You remember those days? You remember that time I saw you outside the building, and then I went back into the building and I saw you sitting at that desk, and then I went back out and then I saw you sitting outside, and I thought, how could he be in two places at once?
All right. Now, listen, well, someone's just called you a charlatan, and so I'd like to throw myself under the bus with you.
Yeah.
Well,
okay. I told Stuart this story. I think we were off air about this horse with the broken leg. Mm-hmm. So this is where I'm going to throw my – oh, the cat just had an accident. That's where I'd like to throw myself under the bus. All I know is I've had some very strange experiences, whoever it is in chat. I can't see you properly because you're covered by all these signs. I can't read chat properly because it keeps saying relaunch browser. Please save all your words.
That's all right. I've got it.
You've got it.
What are they asking?
I can see the chat really well.
Jag's looking after chat.
I'm looking after chat. It's all good. Yeah.
But the point I'd like to make is I was telling Stuart and Jag, I had this really weird experience. My girlfriend's horse broke its leg. We were 80 miles from the nearest vet. It was on a Sunday. We decided to wait. This horse was on three legs.
Jill,
yeah, what?
The chat is saying they're actually talking about Uri Geller as the charlatan, not Mr. Premlow.
Oh, doctor. A surgeon is Mr. and a
I'm sure it's not a Mrs.
Demoted back to doctor.
look, I just quickly want to say one little thing. Sorry, I know I cut you off. But look, I don't think there's anything wrong with someone seeing something that other people think is not there. Personally, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. It doesn't mean that it's there and doesn't mean that it's not there. Because everything you're seeing is light going through your eyes into your brain and being interpreted by you. And I realized this once when I asked a very stupid question to my colorblind friend. I said, what do you see when you see red? And he looked at me funny and he said, well, I see red.
I have two colorblind sons, red, green, colorblind.
Well, he was red, green, colorblind, and he says, well, what I see, I've always called it red. So I call that red, you know.
One of the sons has got a perfect sense of clothing and color. He just asks people around him that he knows can see red and green.
Okay, you listen, we're going to segue quickly. We've got to wrap up in 2 minutes. No, listen to me. I've got to take charge.
You might
listen to me, Jag.
That I don't. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it.
Oh.
I'm really sorry, my beautiful friends. Stephen has told me we have 2 minutes left before we wrap up.
Well, tell me.
I want to quickly segue to the papers that have just come out in the leading psychiatric journals. Stuart's just had some of his latest papers published because, contrary to popular belief, the world of academia still regards him as sane, even though he has turned invisible and had stigmatas coming from his body. So what are the papers that you've just what's the latest happening in the bullying world, Stuart?
Well, if you're in the United States, you'll see me in USA Today and in Columbia Dispatch. And there's a paper that came out of a British study that showed prolonged bullying affected and traumatized victims throughout life until they were 45 or 50 years of age. This is a British study I remember started in the 1950s early and followed up a cohort of about 8,000 kids to show that prolonged school bullying is extremely damaging.
Yes.
And the reason I thought you'd find it interesting was when I saw this and I was sworn to secrecy, that I would not disclose this article to anybody else until today. That I would be looking at some word from God. All it says is if you traumatize somebody relentlessly during childhood, they will carry the trauma into their adult life. Excuse me?
Yeah, like,
what
wow.
is so unusual about that?
Yeah, exactly.
So I was looking for... I'm not seeing why this is a secret paper. It's entirely expected.
Yes.
Any sort of trauma that's relentless will leave a mark on a person that they will carry till they die.
Yes.
So why is this? All I could say was, I do hope the government is listening And it's your government, and it's the British government. And this was a British study, by the way.
Yes.
The American government. We're trying to do all these things to help bullying in schools that are 100% ineffective. They really are. Even if they work during the time that the project is being done and funded, the moment the funding stops, the results stop. None of them are sustainable. We think we have a way of doing it. And we came to this conclusion this paper came to in 2001. And since then, we've been doing work all over the world, including, by the way, as you know, Jill, in your country.
Yes.
In your country since 2005.
I know. I'm really sorry I only met you on your last trip, but anyway.
Right. And so we've been trying. We've tried it in Finland. We've tried it in, we have a project now in Hungary. We have a project in Jamaica and several in the United States to try and show that you can only manage trauma in people who collectively wish to not be traumatized.
Right.
Not just one child to be not traumatized. Because what will happen is their parents will drive themselves crazy and be unable to do it. It has to be a collective effort of the whole school. And this paper is an example of it. This has been a really weird discussion. Religious experience and LSD to bullying.
Yep, it's fantastic. But you did want us to, I did want to mention that. And we'll talk about that maybe next week, because I think we all bully each other. I think a topic on bullying could go really, really well, especially now that they know that you're completely kooky and they'll be waiting for some
charlatan. Let me just tell you this.
No, you're not the charlatan. You turned out to be some other thing.
I did not make a single penny out of this. Nobody paid me. All of this was done for nothing. Just out of personal interest. I wasn't in a midlife crisis. I wasn't in the middle of ending my marriage. I was a healthy skeptic, interested in unusual phenomena.
The Tibetans, this is what really annoys me. The people are so narrow-minded and we think we're so open-minded. Some people, you know, like miracles do happen. We just shouldn't call them miracles. They're actually just normal. You know, it's just that we get so closed down. Like when I was a little kid, I had all sorts of psychedelic experiences, and they were just part of being alive. I used to see all sorts of hallucinations and dots and swirling things, and I know Tibetans who can turn invisible, and I've literally seen someone turn invisible. I've had a Tibetan Lama Lang Poink on the end of my bed. I've seen heaps of things, but we've run out of time.
Yes.
And
let me back to Jag one moment.
Okay.
The main point we need to keep from this interview, this session, it's his comment about how strong the mind is in manifesting within the body and within the community.
Oh, yeah.
That point is absolutely critical in terms of the way we create our own reality. And then we give it all sorts of mystical names. He's absolutely right about that.
Jag and Stuart, thank you so much. We have another guest coming on straight after you who's waiting for us. Thank you, Professor Stuart Twemlow, great yogi, and Jag Seek, great yogurt.
Yogurt. Take care, my dear.
Ciao, guys.
Bye-bye.
Talk to you later. I'll ring you later, Stuart.
See you next week, if possible.